From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Chris Drakwitz grew up in Germany, but his obsession is the regional music of America, blues, Zydeco, Tex-Mex, and country. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about his 30 years documenting this music on his independent label, Arhuli Records. Also today, Elliot from 30-something. Is he a good guy or a jerk? We ask the actor who plays him, Timothy Busfield. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from The Residents and Kris Kristofferson. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie from John Boorman, the director who also made Deliverance and Hope and Glory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. A French-built Ariane rocket exploded 2 minutes after liftoff this afternoon, destroying two Japanese communications satellites and creating a major disaster for the European space program. The president of Ariane Space, Frédéric Delest, said a full investigation would be done before flights resume. The liftoff in French Guiana appeared normal, but about 2 minutes later, an explosion tore through the rocket's first stage, destroying the multimillion-dollar high-tech payload. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega this morning rejected any possibility that his Sandinista party could lose Sunday's election there. Ortega also renewed a call for direct talks with President Bush, which he said could deal specifically with the civil war in El Salvador. David Adams reports.
President Ortega was relaxed and confident as he answered questions from reporters here to cover the elections. He said all the indications from last-minute opinion polls confirmed his party's absolute conviction that they would win comfortably on Sunday. Asked to respond to comments by U.S. Secretary of State James Baker about the future of U.S.-Nicaraguan relations, Ortega said he hoped that relations could be quickly normalized. But he refused to answer directly if his new government would stop supporting the left-wing rebels in El Salvador, as the U.S. has called for. Ortega used the subject of El Salvador to renew a call for U.S. disarmament of the Contra rebels, who are based in camps in neighboring Honduras. Ortega said that Nicaragua was prepared to discuss directly the question of El Salvador with the U.S. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Managua.
Dozens of reporters in a Washington courtroom spent much of the day watching former President Ronald Reagan testify on videotape that he did not know or did not remember much about the Iran-Contra scandal. In testimony for the trial of his former national security advisor, John Poindexter, the former president, insisted he still did not know that money from arms sales to Iran was illegally diverted to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. In Chicago today, the U.S. Justice Department agreed to discontinue a lawsuit against a local apartment complex that used racial quotas to maintain equal numbers of black and white tenants. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Chicago.
The Justice Department sued the board of Atrium Village 3 years ago, charging that the urban apartment complex built by several Chicago churches had violated fair housing laws through the use of a quota system to maintain racial balance in its 309 units. Attorneys for Atrium Village argued that the development had promoted racial integration by using the quotas required by federal and state housing agencies to secure subsidies for the project. Atrium Village no longer employs quotas, and the settlement announced today does not determine whether that method is legal. That decision is to be made by a federal court. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the day down 8.79 points. This is NPR News. It appears Americans are using seatbelts more and staying sober when they're behind the wheel. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says the death rate on the nation's highways fell to its lowest ever last year. The rate was 2.2 deaths per 100 million miles of travel in 1989, down from 2.3 in 1988. In 1980, the rate was 3.3 per 100 million miles. 34 states and the District of Columbia have enacted mandatory seatbelt law since 1984. All states now require child restraint seats and have set the minimum drinking age at 21. The Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party is urging workers to support President Gorbachev's policy of perestroika. The call comes 3 days before a series of planned demonstrations by unofficial groups. The BBC's Bridget Kendall is in Moscow.
In this toughly worded statement published by the official news agency TASS, the Central Committee warned that a great many demonstrations had swept the country recently, and though they'd begun under reasonable slogans, they degenerated into riots and vandalism. and militant forces had manipulated them to stir up national hatred and attempt to demoralize the party, the government, and the Soviet army. Though this address doesn't mention Sunday's planned demonstrations, there's already been a call from the Soviet parliament for the police not to allow illegal rallies on that day. And most Soviet people will see this latest statement as a veiled warning that any sign of trouble will not be tolerated by the authorities. Sunday's demonstrations are being planned by pro-democratic organizations, closely allied to the Interregional Group, the main opposition grouping in the Soviet parliament.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. Czechoslovak President Václav Havel began his day in New York at breakfast with Mayor David Dinkins, then moved on to meetings with the Council on Foreign Relations, UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar, some Czechoslovak Americans, and stopped to pick up academic and religious honors. The breakfast session was worthwhile. Broadway producer Joseph Papp announced he'd produce one of Havel's plays. I'm Bill Redlin in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This is a number we call the Zydeco Cha-Cha, baby.
That's Clifton Chenier, the late king of Zydeco, in one of his many recordings on Arhuli Records. My guest, Chris Strachwitz, is the founder of Arhuli. It's an independent record label based in California, devoted to regional American music like Cajun, Tex-Mex, blues, and country. Strachwitz has traveled around America recording musicians in their homes, as well as in clubs and in the studio. Strachwitz also makes documentaries about regional music with filmmaker Les Blank. They have a new movie about the Cajun and Zydeco music of Louisiana called J'ai été au bal, I Went to the Dance. This year, Arhuli is celebrating its 30th anniversary. We invited Chris Strachwitz in for a mini-retrospective of his work. Though Strachwitz has devoted his adult life to recording the indigenous music of the United States, he was actually born in Germany and came to California as a teenager in 1947. He told me he first heard the music of the American South on the radio.
I think that was my first exposure to all of it. And I was absolutely wiped out by it. I guess I had a lot of insecure feelings. I couldn't speak the language. I was real skinny. And somehow the blues that I heard, I think, spoke to me the strongest. I'll never forget that first record by Lightning Hopkins. I heard, Hello Central, please give me 209. I want to talk to my baby. She's way on down the line. And it just blew me away. And I also loved hillbilly music. I heard T-Texas Tyler, the Maddox Brothers and Rose, and gospel music. I heard the St. Paul Baptist Church Choir over a station out of Los Angeles. All of that, you know, it was just, the radio was my ear to the world, so to speak. And I think part of my love affair with this music has been my love affair with meeting these other cultures.
When you started collecting records, where did you go to get them? I mean, I think a lot of people thought of 78s as junk, that they'd just sell in flea markets or give them away.
Well, that was at that time the only kind of record. That was the only one in existence. It was a marvelous medium. And it turned out almost every kind of vernacular music was recorded. And I found out it slowly. I didn't have any money, but I would save my allowances. And once in a while, I could splurge and buy myself a 78. And I would wear them out, I can tell you that.
What made you decide to try to record people and meet the people whose records you were listening to and record new records by them?
Well, since I was so enamored with this whole idea of records and what's on them, you know, I always collected things and stamps before that, but records, you could hear what's in those grooves. And I guess I was simply amazed by it all. And when I came up here to Northern California, I met people like Bob Geddens, a black man originally from Texas who was recording here in the Bay Area. And then I met a man named Jackson. He lived on 7th Street in West Oakland. He was recording literally in his back room with one microphone and a disc cutter, you know, where you cut directly to disc. Those early 78s were all done that way. And I simply was amazed that this is all it takes. I first thought to make a record, you go into one side of a factory of a huge place, an artist goes in, and out on the other side come the records. But I had no idea what the in-between process was. And sort of meeting all these people taught me.
Some of the early music that you recorded was Zydeco music in Louisiana, at house parties, in bars. I want to play one of those early sessions, but before I play it, tell us what Zydeco is and how it's distinguished from, say, Cajun music.
Yeah, I didn't know what Zydeco music was either when I first went down there in 1960 or 59, so I simply asked people, what does Zydeco mean? And some of them said, well, it means snap beans, not salty. It's an old tune that everybody knew. Others said, oh, it's just going out in the country and having a party, going to the Zydeco, going to party and having a good time playing music, push and pull, you know, that accordion music. And so that's basically what it is. It's the music of the French-speaking Creoles, blacks in southwest Louisiana, in contrast to the white Cajun music.
Now, I want to play something that you made in the early 1960s. This is called Tap Dance. It's by a group, McZeal and Gergner. Tell us where you recorded this, who they are.
Well, I'm really not too sure who they were at that time. I was just wandering around and just asking people. You know, I was driving. And they said, oh, yeah, I met them somehow through someone else. And they said, we're playing a little house party. Come on over and join us, you know. And so I did. I simply went to this little house in Lafayette, I believe it was. And they played for me, and there was a bunch of people having a good time at the house. And they were very typical of the little Zydeco groups that were all over the place, usually just accordion and rubboard. In Houston...
Rubboard is like washboard?
Yeah, like a washboard. And at that time, they were still pretty much looked like a washboard. I later found out that some of them would take pieces out of an old icebox where there was corrugated steel in them, and they would cut out a piece that they can scrape on. Because the regular old washboard, see, that metal is much too soft. It just wears through in no time when you're scraping away on it with beer can openers and all that sort of stuff. So they were using a corrugated metal, steel metal, right off the bat. And now it's become a real fashionable instrument that was sort of invented by Clifton Chenier, or by his brother Cleveland Chenier, who was really one of the giants of the whole genre. And they went down to a guy once, Clifton told me, he said, I went down to the steel company and told him, can you make me one like this? And he said he drew it in the sand as to how he wanted it, with this collar on it that would fold back over his shoulders, you know, and then hanging in front of his chest. And they said, sure, we can make that. And that's how these rubboards were made that you see now being worn by almost all the rubboard players.
Well, let's go to this 1961 recording that you made at a house party in Lafayette, Louisiana. Recorded in 1961 by my guest Chris Drakwitz, who's the founder and head of Arhuli Records, which is a record company that features regional music from around America and also music from other parts of the world. Had there been much Cajun and Zydeco music recordings made before you started making them in the early 60s?
Oh, yes, lots of them. Not much in the way of black recordings, no, but a lot of the first Cajun recording was made in 1928 by Joe Falcon. But in subsequent years, relatively little black material was recorded, except Alan Lomax did some extraordinary field work in the early 30s. But it wasn't a commercial entity, and really until about that time, and Clifton Chenier had already had a hit by the time I met him, but the one hit had sort of worn out when I met him, and he was absolutely almost insisting that I record him, that he wanted to get a record out back on the jukeboxes, because that was their meal ticket, you know. So he was really the main one that I recorded, because I wasn't sure if I could sell that type of thing. I met Clifton through Lightning Hopkins. They are cousins, you see. And I wasn't sure if I could sell it. I knew I could sell blues, because my European clientele had already told me, you know, oh, we love these blues. And I was beginning to get an inkling of that, because I was selling old 78s to Europe. That's how I actually made my first money, to buy a tape recorder and stuff. But the other things, the French music, I wasn't too sure at all about.
Why don't we take a short break? Then we'll talk some more and play some more records. And my guest is Chris Strachwitz, who is the founder and head of Arhuli Records, a small label that features regional music from around the United States as well as music from other parts of the world. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chris Strachwitz is my guest, and we're talking about regional music in the United States, which is what he records on his Arhuli record label. Let's play something by Fred McDowell. Now, this is also one of the early recordings that you made. He was a Mississippi blues guitarist and singer, and probably the most famous record that you recorded of his is You Gotta Move, which was later covered by the Rolling Stones.
Well, I guess that's the one that became famous because they did it, you know. And he was an extraordinary person. I was wiped away when I heard the Alan Lomax collection from Mississippi. And I remember I wrote to Alan Lomax, where is this man from? And he gave me an address in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And I went to the post office, where's Route so-and-so? He said, oh, it's out there, north of Highway 61. Go out there. And I met him just getting off a tractor. And I recorded that record there the same night. Not this particular one, but that first album. I don't think he sang You Got to Move on that first night we recorded, but what a wonderful person, Fred McDowell. He loved his music, and he was just as passionate about it as anybody I've ever encountered. And he would play on. If you meet him, he didn't care if he's getting paid or not. He loved what he was doing. It was just a sheer joy, that man.
Let me play something that you recorded by him in 1965. This is You Gotta Move.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But when that law get ready, you got to move. You may be high, you may be low.
Fred McDowell singing You've Gotta Move. Now, this is a song attributed to Fred McDowell. Is it ever hard to tell who actually wrote a song, a blues song? Because there seems to be so many permutations of more or less the same song. And I found in books that I read that sometimes songs are attributed to different people, depending on who you're reading.
It's a real problem. In that particular instance, it's a traditional song, but the arrangement is by Fred McDowell. Reverend Gary Davis also had a very distinctive arrangement of it. But you sort of remind me of the fact that, you know, as I got into this whole music thing, one slowly begins to realize what responsibilities one has. And that was one of the early ones I think I encountered. This whole business of copywriting, because when you're recording someone, or you're really capturing some of their talent, or you're capturing some of their ideas, people who write books, you know, okay, they go to a publisher and they have their books written and copyright and all that. But these vernacular musicians don't, and so you're really responsible for protecting them. And I learned this really primarily from a good old buddy down in South Louisiana, Eddie Schuler. He once heard my tapes, you know, I played them to him, and he says, Chris, what do you want that stuff for? Get their songs. I said, what do you mean get their songs? I got them right there on the tape. No, man, that ain't what I'm talking about. Copyrights, get their copyrights. If Frank Sinatra or the Beatles want to make a big hit out of it, you know, then if you got the copyright, that's where you make the money, and you share that with the composer. So I kind of learned that, you know, You don't read that in books, but you begin to realize what responsibilities you have in life.
So how did you handle it on You Gotta Move?
You opened a can of worms. Okay. Mr. Klein, who was the manager of the Rolling Stones, he insisted, of course, that everything the Stones recorded was theirs. However, Mick Jagger was good enough to put on the first recording of that particular version that they did the name of Fred McDowell. He listed that as the composer on the Atlantic label. Okay, all hell broke loose. I said, Fred, where did you learn this song? He said, Chris, I learned it out of a book. And then Manny Greenhill, who represented Reverend Gary Davis, called me and he said, Chris, you know Reverend Gary Davis wrote that song, not Fred McDowell. I says, Manny, you and everybody else knows it's a traditional song. It's their various arrangements that may be worth copywriting here, you know. And so we finally headed out, and we agreed that as long as somebody would record Fred McDowell's version, which had that slide guitar, very eerie sort of thing, it would be mostly going to Fred McDowell. If they were recording the very finger-picked guitar style of Reverend Gary Davis's version, he would get most of the copyrights, but it is a traditional song, and I think all you can do is handle the arrangement of it. And Fred McDowell was, before he died, he was absolutely amazed. I handed him a check for over $7,000. He says, Chris, I can't believe it, but I'm glad somebody out there likes my music.
Before we hear some more regional music, I want to ask you if you think there is still regional music.
Oh, yes, very, very, very much so.
You don't worry that it's kind of dying out and that things are becoming more homogenized?
No, people
nationally?
Always talk about that. You know, things change, but they don't die out. But I'm constantly amazed of, in spite of this extraordinary power that the media has over almost world culture now, you know, these things go on, they evolve, they multiply, it changes, but it's still very much regional things go on, oh yes.
Well, let's get to the border region and play some music of the Southwest. You have a film that you did along with Les Blank. It's called Chulas Fronteras.
Chulas Fronteras, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
we did that, that's almost over 10 years, 15 years ago, but it's still a classic.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of music are you playing on here?
This is what most people down there call conjunto music. But, of course, the Spanish word conjunto simply means group. In Cuba, they call groups conjuntos, etc. But down there in South Texas, it means a group that consists of button accordion, a bajo sexto, which is a big fat 12-string guitar, a bass, and drums usually. And that was the popular music at the time in the 60s. It still is pretty strong, but, you know, tastes do change and the kids go for something a little bit more modern, sort of schmaltzy nowadays. But conjunto music at its best was this absolutely powerful, powerful, what shall I say, vernacular music of that time and the place. You know, it still goes on strong, yeah.
Well, this is the according to Flaco Jimenez, and the song is Mojado Sin Licencia.
Mojado Sin Licencia, a wetback without a license. That was written by his father, the late Santiago Jimenez, yeah.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
Desde la arena. Flaco Jimenez is recorded in the mid-1970s. Chris Drakwitz, what are some of the recent developments happening in border music now?
Well, it still goes on pretty much in that tradition, but they are also, a lot of the youngsters seem to like more the grupos, as they call them. You know, they use electric organs or synthesizers instead of the accordion, and, you know, things do change and so on. But they still play basically a lot of polkas, a lot of waltzes, because people love to dance, and it's still social dancing. It's not just hopping around like Flaco Jimenez once told me. He just came back from his first Anglo gig in Austin, and I said, how did it go? I said, man, those people dance, but they dance funny. They're like kangaroos. They hop around. So I think the music down there is strong and goes on, and there are festivals now. There's a Conjunto Festival every year in San Antonio, done sponsored by the Guadalupe Cultural Center. It's a marvelous event every May. You should go.
You started collecting records back in the days of 78. You started making records with very, you know, pretty primitive tape recording equipment. Well, now we're in the CD era, the compact disc era, and you are reissuing some of your records on CD and issuing new records on compact disc. I'm wondering what kind of pressures it puts on a small company like yours to enter the CD age. I assume that it's a much more expensive format.
You're right.
Put
just
out.
Just about put me in my grave. I figured I'm either going to retire or get with it. And so I decided I'm going to get with it. So I've spent the last year literally working 12 hours a day trying to remaster stuff, trying to get money together to do this. I've just spent, I think, close to $150,000, which I had somehow saved up over the last 10 years because I had a feeling something was going to happen. And so I'm in the CD era now, but it's a very expensive proposition and a time-consuming thing because I don't want to just put out CDs that simply duplicate the LPs I did. I figure here is a new medium. I should start from scratch. I should go back to the original tapes, and I can make over 60-minute programs, you know, that just really represent the best of the stuff that I taped, and that's what I'm doing.
Do you find that record stores don't carry many albums anymore and that CDs are pushing out records?
Oh, yes, that's definitely. I mean, it's a total insane luxury to have three sound carriers. You know, that's just, it's ludicrous because it's not only time-consuming. I mean, when you have billion-dollar items, then I can see it. You know, they don't really care what form they issued on toothpaste boxes or on razor blades or whatever. But a little guy who only has so much time and money, it's murderous. I mean, I'm spending so much money and time just trying to, and every item like the cassette, the CD, I got to listen to it when it comes back, you know, to test it, make sure it's okay. The packaging, the little inserts, the booklets, you got to read it over again. I mean, it just takes time. And so I don't think the people out there should blame anybody except the guys who invent this stuff. So let's hope the CD hangs around for a while, but I know the chip is coming down the road. Who knows? Oh boy, will the Matchbox hold my clothes, huh?
Chris Drakwitz, he's celebrating the 30th anniversary of our Hooli Records this year. He and filmmakers Les Blank and Maureen Gosling have just released a new film about the music of Louisiana. It's called J'ai été au bal, I Went to the Dance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, diet fads and end of the millennium apocalyptic visions. Hillel Schwartz has written cultural histories of both. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On TV's 30-something, Nancy was recently diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Her husband, Elliot, is feeling sorry for her and sorry for himself. But what about actor Timothy Busfield, who plays Elliot? How does he feel about this cancer subplot? Coming up, we find out. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Kris Kristofferson and The Residents. Their music is very different, but Ken says they're both using their new albums as vehicles for social commentary. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews John Boorman's new movie, Where the Heart Is. It stars Dabney Coleman as a father who decides it's time for his kids to make it on their own. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to news report from Czechoslovakia, Prague and Moscow have reached agreement on the pullout of Soviet troops. That agreement is to be signed in Moscow when details of the pullout will be announced. It's now believed that over 73,000 Soviet troops are in Czechoslovakia. Prague wants the Soviet troops out by the end of the year, while the Soviet Union has said it needs more time. The West German government today again turned down Polish demands to take part in German reunification talks. Deidre Berger reports from West Berlin.
There will be no Polish delegation at unity talks between East and West Germany, according to West German government spokesman Dieter Vogel. The Polish government has asked to be part of the talks as an assurance that its current borders will not be changed. Bonn spokesman Vogel today said Poland and other neighboring countries would be consulted, but cannot participate in the talks between the two Germanies and the four World War II Allied powers. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl maintains a border guarantee with Poland can only be signed by a reunited German government. In contrast, East German leader Hans Modrow supports the Polish position that a border guarantee be signed before unification talks are finished. The British government today said it backs the Polish government's demand. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
The Israeli Labor Party has threatened to pull out of the ruling National Unity Coalition unless the government adopts a U.S. compromise formula on Middle Eastern peace talks. This ultimatum comes on the eve of a meeting in Washington between Israeli Foreign Minister Ahrens and Secretary of State Baker, who today told Congress that he's waiting for Israel's reply. Patricia Golan has more on the story.
The coalition led by Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's right-wing Likud party has been unable to agree on Baker's proposals, which would make it possible to hold a meeting between Israelis and Palestinians in Egypt on elections in the Israeli-occupied territory. Likud has stalled, fearing the PLO was being given a role in the talks. Frustrated over the delays, Labor has long toyed with the idea of pulling out of the government. The Labor Party resolution, adopted unanimously today, gives the government 2 weeks to decide on the issues that will continue the peace process. What makes this ultimatum credible is the support of Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin, one of the authors of the original election proposal, who until today has opposed giving Likud any kind of deadline. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Victor Lasky, journalist and author, has died at the age of 72. Lasky, a victim of cancer, died today in a Washington hospital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 9 points to close at 2,574.77, on volume of some 185,400,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker says in some songs, the message the performers are trying to get across is more important than the music, and he has a review of two new albums that illustrate his point. The King and I, from the San Francisco-based veteran musical performance artists known as The Residents, and Third World Warrior from Kris Kristofferson and his band, The Border Lords.
You can't defeat him, he's fighting for freedom. That's all he wanted, that's all he needs. You'll never beat him with weapons and money. There ain't no chain as strong as the will to be free.
Kris Kristofferson's new album, Third World Warrior, is the singer-songwriter's brave, probably doomed attempt to set his progressive political beliefs to music. This collection of songs combines manifesto-like lyrics with his flat monotone of a voice. The result is a series of intense pronouncements. They could have been self-righteous and insufferable, but for the most part, Kristofferson pulls it off. He's made a very odd, very uncommercial, but very compelling album.
running for the border and her life. Like the wind, straight into the terror of the night. She survived, bargaining her body for their gold. In the end, all she had to sell them was her soul. So we go, love of money.
Like Jackson Browne, Kris Kristofferson has decided to turn his back on popular success at a point in his career when he needs it most. His records don't sell well and his movie career seems stalled, yet instead of caving in and trying to write another Me and Bobby McGee or Help Me Make It Through the Night, Kristofferson has opted to write about what he's really concerned about just now, which is the politics of Latin America and the mistakes he believes the U.S. is making there. His songs are repetitive scolds, but there's also something undeniably interesting, even heroic, about them.
Anybody see them? I heard there was a baby. Somebody heard her cry, weaker through the night. They beat her mama bloody, shot her with her daddy. Was the terror from above. Águila del Norte, Águila del Norte, down in Nicaragua, running from the shadows, striking holy terror deeper in the heart. You believe in freedom. Believe in justice. Not in Nicaragua. Not in Nicaragua.
It may seem peculiar to contrast Kris Kristofferson, widely known at the very least as a movie star, with The Residents, barely known at most as a hip cult act. Yet The Residents' new release, The King and I, is as relentlessly messagey as Third World Warrior. The King and I is The Residents' effort to comment specifically on the enduring celebrity of Elvis Presley and more generally on the pointlessness of celebrity itself.
Well, there's one bowl of money, two bowl of show. Three to get ready, now go get go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down. Step on my face, slander my name all over the place. I'd do anything that you wanna do, but oh, honey, lay off of them shoes. Burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor from my old fruit jar. Do anything that you wanna do, but oh, honey, lay off of them shoes. Don't you step on my blue suede shoes.
Over the course of The King and I, The Residents offer a series of Elvis Presley hits, flattened out, stripped of their original rhythms and spirit, sung in nearly as inexpressive a monotone as Kristofferson's. Both acts hammer away at a single idea. Kristofferson's is, war is bad. The Residents' is, being famous is bad. So why is The Residents' work so much less provocative?
I don't want no other love.
Perhaps the King and I is just a fluke. Certainly in the past, the Residents, a group which always appears in disguise and never reveals its musicians' names, has made some fine satirical music. This time around, though, their joke is churlish and banal. Wailing away at Elvis for being big and famous, for being the great white whale of rock, is a staggering cliché in 1990. Both Kristofferson and the Residents have made what amount to one-note records, but it's Kristofferson, whose career is as cold as the Residents is cool, who's made the better one.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the new magazine, Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. As this season of 30-something started, things seemed to be going well for Elliot Weston. He was back together with his wife, Nancy. Then Nancy was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and had a hysterectomy. And Elliot is having trouble facing it. My guest, Timothy Busfield, plays Elliot. This is a scene from one of the cancer episodes called Post-Op. Elliot is in a bar with his friend Michael getting drunk.
I can get a new wife, Mike. No problem. I mean, who needs her? She's got stretch marks. She does. She's got stretch marks on her stomach. I mean, I get my life together, and she gets cancer. I mean, she wanted me back. She wanted to be this big family thing, and then bam, cancer. Nice going, Nance.
Let me ask you how you found out about the cancer plot.
Well, it's not, you know, they, if there's anything the actors know about, and it's very little on 30-something, it's what the course of their character is going to take in that season, what might happen or what sort of route they're going to try to lead us in, what direction they're going to lead us in. And I was aware of the cancer storyline at the end of last season. They discussed not discussed it with us for positive feedback, but told us that we may be, you know, involved in a cancer storyline with Nancy. And then when we came back this year, we established it. And I don't look at the scripts until they turn blue. And I know that sounds strange, but what I mean by that is the first draft of a script comes out and it's white. And the next script comes out after the producers have rewritten it, and then it's blue. And often what is lost between the white and the blue is are things that I really love. And so I don't even read the whites anymore. So I don't get the advance notice on what's going to happen until we're just about ready to shoot, when the blue script comes out, which is generally 2 days or a day before we start filming. So that's the closest I get to what's going to go on.
Is Nancy's cancer good or bad for Timothy Busfield's career?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's good for my career, I think, in the respect that the material I get is very strong. The storyline, I feel, is very, you know, it's a very believable storyline. Patty Wettig's work in it, I think, is wonderful. The only bad part, I think, for Tim Busfield's career is that, if they kill Nancy, then you're taking my partner away from me. And she's made me look awful good over the last few years. And working with her has been, the relationship has been wonderful. We set each other up. We know what each other's thinking. We work very well together, and that's a hard thing to find in any business with a partner. And I would hate to lose that. And I think if I lost that, I think hopefully not, but the quality of some of my storylines might go down.
I'm interested in what your take is on the character of Elliot, the character you play in 30-something.
Mm-hmm. My take on Elliot. You mean as far as what he's all about, why he is the way he is, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, is he a nice guy, finally? Is he a jerk underneath?
I think he was always a nice guy and always a jerk. I think that Elliot has always been sort of your basic, to me, your basic man in many ways, in that conditioned to be the breadwinner, the father, from a long line of men that it was probably okay to sleep around, you know, to be the male, the image of being a man. And he did a couple of things that many women perceive as awful and many men perceive as awful. But also there are several men who felt like Elliot was totally in the right in the way he treated Nancy and what he went through, as did several women. So it's a tough one to sort of pigeonhole.
Do you feel that you have to defend the character because you're playing him?
No, I don't. What do you mean, defend him? I'm not defending him. What are you talking about? No, I don't know. I like when I encourage them to make Elliot more of a pig. I like it. My favorite moments are the moments when he asks Nancy, "Doesn't she? You know, don't you ever shave your legs anymore?" That to me, that kind of stuff. I love that. I read it. When I read it, I blushed and I started sweating. I said, "I can't believe that this is gonna that I'm gonna say this. This is awful. People are gonna twist and turn, and women are gonna hit their husbands. You know, that have said some. I mean, this is gonna create a fuss." I love that kind of stuff. That's when the show is at its best, and I really like that.
I want to ask you about something that you did before 30 something, and that is Trapper John, M.D. You were Trapper John's son.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know anyone who actually watched the show when you were on?
Terry, that's awful. That's awful. Wait a second. I hope not. You're awful. That was, I knew maybe 9 or 10 people that watched the show, mostly in prisons, I mean, because it was the only thing you could watch between 10 and 11. I thank God. You know, I remember when I got Trapper John, and I was excited that it was in its sixth season and the people weren't watching it anymore. Because what, to me, Trapper John represented was not a break, and certainly not, I knew joining a series in its sixth year that I was not going to become some young phenom. The press was done with the show. Nobody in the industry was watching Trapper John anymore. But what I got from Trapper John is I got 39 episodes in front of a film camera and doing basically B-movies, one a week, for, you know, 7 days of a shooting schedule in front of a camera. And I got relaxed and very confident in my working process. And I developed a lot of my process. I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I mean, there was very difficult to make that show real because you're saying, you know, words with no vowels, you know, with some disease based on some Swedish doctor, who didn't never left his laboratory for 29 years and developed some cure for some disease. So you end up saying things like a patient's tachypnic, you know, with a non-productive cough, and they just came off corticosteroids, and it could be pneumocystis. We need to get him to 100 milligrams meperidine IV stat. I don't know what one of those things means. Don't know where they came from. I don't know how to take. I have to take a pulse in 20 seconds and then talk to somebody and deal with a mother who's crumbling because her child is falling to pieces in front of me. And I'm saying words I don't know and taking a pulse on the wrong side of the thing. I don't know how to pump the thing. I don't know what I'm doing. I had no idea what I was doing on Trapper John.
Well, it gave you an opportunity to work with Pernell Roberts. Had you been a big Bonanza fan, or did you still think of him as Cartwright?
I be honest with you, Adam was always my favorite. I was very honored to be Pernell's son. You know, I look more like Magic Johnson's son than I do Pernell Roberts' son. I don't think there's a lot of similarity there. But it was fun. I learned a lot, actually, from Pernell.
Did you find out why he always wore black on Bonanza?
No, I didn't ask him that. You didn't. Bonanza wasn't the subject to talk about with Pernell. He wasn't real talking about, I mean, there were a couple jokes he would make of Bonanza, but I very seldom talk. I was warned rather early, do not discuss Bonanza with Pernell.
You're hosting a new cable program. It's a special about divorce, and it's about how divorcing parents should make sure that they're not divorcing their children as well as each other. Now, you're hosting this as someone who had divorced parents, who is divorced himself and remarried, and who plays someone who had left his wife on 30-something. In a way, it's kind of like fostering the connection between you, Timothy Busfield, and your character of Elliot. Do you know what I mean? And I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, it doesn't. You know, I'm a little afraid that I will become the the divorce, you know, the father of divorce, you know. I mean, that's not actually, I'm not too concerned with that. But in knowing that might be a possibility, that connection would be drawn between my life and Elliot's life. I looked at that and thought about that and thought, what the heck? I think this is real important, what we're trying to say here. And this is more of a personal thing than Elliot. It's more of a personal thing than Tim Busfield, the actor, and his career. The documentary to me is a very important documentary in that the way it examines divorce. I am, in my personal life, I have a 7-year-old son, Willie, who I have joint custody with, and I have to raise this 7-year-old not being with him. And it's a very delicate, difficult, hard thing to do. And I am very much still a partner with my ex-wife as far as that goes.
How old were you when your parents divorced?
I was 2.
Was as you were growing up, was it an embarrassment that they divorced? This was close to 30 years ago,
yeah,
right? When there weren't many parents divorcing.
Well, you know,
that's what you were led to believe in middle class neighborhoods.
Exactly. I remember my girlfriend when I was 16, coming over to my house and complete tears, and I was like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And she said, "I just found out my dad had been married before." She had no idea that this had gone on, and I think a lot more people had been divorced in the 50s than we thought at one point. It just wasn't discussed. It was, I think, more embarrassing for my older sister, who was 10 at the time, because she was more into the peer environment, peer pressure, and I didn't care about my friends. I had no peer pressure. I just knew that Dad wasn't coming home anymore, and I don't even remember most of that. And as I grew up, I just grew up with it, and it was accepted.
Do you think you were more frightened of having a divorce yourself, having been a child who grew up with divorced parents?
I don't think so. No, I think, as a matter of fact, you know, I think it helped me make that decision. It took the pressure off me that I was, you know, ruining a long line of Busfield tradition, you know, and that kind of pressure. I didn't have to live with that. My parents had been divorced, and it was, you know, it was difficult, but it wasn't like I was breaking new ground, I think, which is when it's always the most difficult.
Listen, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Timothy Busfield hosts an upcoming special on Lifetime called Don't Divorce the Children. You can see him regularly on ABC's 30-something. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. So what's the story on the transcripts of Ronald Reagan's testimony on Iran-Contra?
Well, first of all, Terry, we have transcripts because although the tapes have been shown to reporters, they haven't been released. But we are going to be reading some excerpts from those transcripts on the air. The president describes what he thought he was doing in sending arms to Iran. He says repeatedly that he did not think he was doing anything wrong. And then he displays some really surprising, interesting, amazing areas in which he claims he didn't know things that were on the front page of the paper. It's fascinating.
Well, thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. British film director John Borman has a new movie that opens this weekend. Borman's films include Deliverance, Excalibur, The Emerald Forest, and Hope and Glory. Stephen Schiff has a review of Borman's latest, Where the Heart Is.
There's a kind of folly certain smart directors are prone to, especially the ones who, like John Borman, have dared to create exotic new worlds on the screen. Now Borman has announced that he wants to move toward what he calls simpler human stories. I think, he says, it's a matter of opening my heart. Well, his heart is wide open in Where the Heart Is, and it's not always a pretty sight. Like Paul Mazursky when he made Tempest, or Alain René with almost every film he shoots these days, Borman has turned toward a balmier, more whimsical style, a style by which he means to express his wonderment at the joys of family life. Trouble is, Borman hasn't figured out where whimsy ends and sappiness begins. Where the Heart Is a dotty old grandpa of a movie. It rocks back and forth, grinning, and cooing, "Oh, those wonderful young people." Of course, Borman intended a somewhat larger statement. His movie tries to be about homelessness, about the cruelty of capitalism, about greed's emergence in the 80s as a kind of art form. The movie's hero is Stuart McBain, played by the curmudgeonly Dabney Coleman. He's a New York demolition tycoon whose craft is the perfect destruction of wonderful old buildings. His three aimless teenage children live the untroubled life of young monarchs, until one day McBain decides he's had enough. Whisking them in the middle of the night from sleek Manhattan to a run-down Brooklyn side street, he shows his kids a ramshackle, deserted old tenement that he owns, but has been unable to destroy for legal reasons. Here, he decides, is where they're finally going to learn to fend for themselves.
I'm giving it to you kids.
What? I guess we could fix it up with the right decorator. Dad, I don't think we're really ready to live on our own yet.
Ah, honey, think of it as just a little survival test. It'll be fun.
You mean it's only a game?
It's a game, exactly. Yeah, but with very strict rules, son. No designers. You get to do all that yourselves. But I'll give you money. I'll give you, say, $750 each. And the game will start right now.
At first, the kids are nonplussed, but then they start using their talents, and they invite their equally talented pals to come live with them. Pretty soon, the house is full of bubbly young painters and fashion designers and computer jocks, all dancing and singing and falling in love with one another. It's a fantasy of the sweetness of youth, and it plays like a dum-dum version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Meanwhile, back in the real world, the stock market crashes, McBain loses his job, and suddenly he has to move in with the very kids he's evicted. This development, of course, is intended to be a barrel of ironic laughs, but nothing quite works as intended in this movie. That's partly because Borman has directed his actors to mug and play cute, and most of them come off the worse for it. Besides, Borman and his daughter Telsha, who wrote the screenplay together, haven't structured it well. They never show us enough of the relationships between parents and kids for us to feel anything when those relationships are sundered, or again when the family is reunited. In the end, all that comes through is Borman's gift for visual sleight of hand, and his sincerity. Where the heart is certainly heartfelt. The organ it bypasses, unfortunately, is the big one up north.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're just 10 years away from the year 2000. On the next Fresh Air, cultural historian Hillel Schwartz discusses the visions of apocalypse and a new age that accompany the end of a century and a millennium. Also, new rock from Eastern and Western Europe and what they're dancing to in Tokyo. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.